You may be seated. Thank you. All right, the last and final argument for this morning is William Baker versus Rapid City Regional Hospital. Before I introduce the attorneys, we have two new, for those of you that have been in here this morning, we have two new justices sitting with us who are replacing our regular two of our regular members who had conflicts in this case. To my immediate right is retired Justice John Konenkamp, who sat with this court for about 20 years, and we're very happy to have him back and sitting with us today. And then we have to my far right, Judge Stacy Benberg Wickery, who is a Seventh Circuit judge here in Pennington County and is sitting for Justice Devaney this morning. So we appreciate both of their willingness to sit with us and conference on the case. With that, then, the attorneys that are appearing this morning, we have Michael Simpson, who appears on behalf of the appellant, William Baker, and Jennifer Woese, who is appearing on behalf of the appellees, Rapid City Regional Hospital and Hartford Insurance Company. Each side will have 20 minutes to present your initial arguments, and then Mr. Simpson, you'll have a 10-minute rebuttal to conclude the arguments this morning. There is a warning light up here. It's small to see, but it'll show yellow when there's 2 minutes left, and I'll try to give you a warning so you know when you're coming up on your time. With that, then, Mr. Simpson, you can proceed with your initial argument.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Mike Simpson. I represent William Baker in this.
You might just pull that mic up a little bit so they can hear you.
Sure.
Better. Thank you.
And this is a workers' comp appeal. I guess I want to start out maybe by just setting out the basic issues in a nutshell. The first issue really is our contention that the circuit court minimized Mr. Baker's psychological disability, and in particular, his PTSD and the hypervigilance and the paranoia that kind of flowed from that and that affected him in roughly the 3.5 years that we're talking about here. And then the second issue is whether really if those severe restrictions as a result of the paranoia are accepted, then whether when the burden shifted to the insurance company to prove that there are jobs that are available for someone with all those restrictions, whether they met their burden. And it's our contention that they did not, because their vocational expert didn't contact the employers and tell them anything about Mr. Baker. So I think the central issue really is, what was the severity of Mr. Baker's PTSD during the time frame in question? Now, when lawyers or lay people come into contact with people with severe mental illness, we don't generally make the calls on that. We don't say, oh, you can do this, you can do that, so therefore you can work. We don't make psychological diagnoses. That is left to people who do those things every day, to psychiatrists, psychologists, counselors who have the training and who work with mentally ill people as part of their job. So the first question, I think, in this case, as it is in a lot of these workers' comp appeals, is what did the experts, the people who treated Mr. Baker and saw him on a regular basis during this 3.5 year period, say? And I'd like to start with his treating psychiatrist, Dr. Hamlin, who works for the hospital. Dr. Hamlin saw him on a regular basis, prescribed him medications, and in the summer of 2015, he thought that his PTSD and his post-concussive syndrome was bad enough that he took him off of work. And then in October of 2015, he did release him to do work outside of a hospital setting because being around the hospital was triggering his PTSD. And then shortly after that, in November of 15, he took him off work entirely again. And then he continued that restriction at the end of that year of 2016, or in July of 16, and I think at the end, up until about the end of 16. And then he stopped seeing Mr. Baker because his work comp claim had been closed out, I think. That's what the record shows. So treating psychiatrist sees him on a regular basis. There are findings in the treatment notes. You can look at those. And takes him off of work because of the severity of the PTSD. I should say that during this time frame, we have evidence, which I think is, I don't think I've ever seen in any case I've done, where the insurance company put into evidence basically all of Mr. Baker's writings and lawsuits that he had filed over the course of this period of time. And you can see from reading those that his paranoia, his hypervigilance, his anger, his irritability all got worse and worse and worse over time, such that he was filing lawsuits and was putting in the lawsuits that he was fearful for his life. He wanted restraining orders against the attorney for the insurance company. And it went on and on and on. And that's all in the record. And you can read it. And in my opinion, it's pretty compelling evidence to a layperson that this person is really in the throes of a very bad episode, many-year episode of severe paranoia.
It seems like the issue that we've got in front of us, Mr. Simpson, as you say, relates to, you know, I won't say narrow issue, the principal issue is, of course, is he permanently totally disabled? Which is to say, causation is really not part of the case.
Right.
And so does the medical evidence, as you've described it here, and also, of course, in your brief, apply to employability or just causation? It may apply to both. Can you help, for me anyway, sort out, you know, the weight of that evidence going to, you know, establishing causation, which I don't think is in the case, you seem to agree, versus whether that really goes to the principal issues that we've got to confront here.
Right. So expert testimony is obviously very relevant to causation because you've said that there are complicated issues. We need the opinion of experts on that. Regarding whether his PTSD and his symptoms are severe enough that it would cause him limitations in certain types of employments or certain types of situations, I think is similarly a very complicated issue. And that's why I started out by saying, this is what his treating psychiatrist said. He said he didn't think he could work. So I hope that answers your question. I mean, I think it's,
yeah, I mean, I think there could be some overlap. And I mean, that seems to be maybe your view as well.
But my position is that obviously the Department of Labor judge has to make the call on what his restrictions are, but that has to be informed by what the experts have to say in a case like this, where we're dealing with a very complicated situation. In other words, if you have a case involving low back pain, the doctor's testimony is quite relevant, but there could be testimony that the person is doing things much different than what they're telling the doctor. That would be an example where you could reject a treating doctor's opinion. So in a psychological case such as this, it's, again, we have writings. We have things where you can look at what Mr. Baker's state of mind was throughout this entire period of time. And I think it matches up exactly with what his doctors are saying, which is that he's descending into a very paranoid state that's consuming his life. And the result is that he would not be capable of doing any form of employment.
So I want to ask about the, particularly the treating physicians. A number of times there were different opinions offered where they indicated, you know, Mr. Baker should be off work for maybe a length of period of time, or even just said off work and didn't give a duration for that. I think there was a disability rating. One of the doctors gave 22% permanent partial disability rating. Did any of the doctors ever say you're permanently, totally disabled, not able to work? Was there any opinion from any of the physicians that said that?
There was. So Dr. Manlove was the forensic examiner who saw him, I think, five times and gave an opinion. Dr. Manlove gave an opinion that he was
incapable. But he was more of a consulting than a treating physician.
That's right. He did not treat him. But he said that he was not able to work and that it was permanent. And he gave that opinion in, I believe it was June or July of 16. So about a year, a little more than a year before the hearing. And then he saw him again in 2017 and his condition had worsened. And that report is pretty interesting. In that report, he talked about how it had worsened. And so I think we have Dr. Manlove saying that it was permanent and that he's disabled. And as I mentioned before, Dr. Hamlin, he didn't say that it was permanent. He just said, as of this date, you're off work for this period of time. And then he never came back to the issue because I think his treatment stopped. And then we have Dr. Hastings, who is his psychologist, and she saw him on pretty much a monthly basis through this entire time. I think she saw him 41 times. And in September of 15, she put in her notes, I'm just quoting here, I currently don't believe that William is able to work due to his ongoing physical and neurological symptoms, the concussion and the PTSD. Like Dr. Hamlin, she didn't come back to that. She just said that at that point, and then there's nothing after that date. But we do have a letter from her a year later, roughly, where she says that his agitation and anxiety have increased in the past year due to his conditions. So she said he wasn't able to work in September of 15. Then a year later, she says he's even worse. And that's kind of that's the record here, that if you look at the treatment notes, if you look at the writings, he got much worse as the years went on. So answer to your question is, Manlove, definitely permanent and total disability. Hamlin said he couldn't work.
Well, didn't Manlove state it was a permanent partial disability, not total, as you've just stated?
Yeah. So there's a distinction in the workers' comp law between an impairment rating and a disability. And it's a very common misunderstanding. In fact, I've been doing workers' comp law for over 25 years. I explain this concept to my clients all the time, because they get an impairment rating of 5% or 10% for their low back injury or for a shoulder injury. And they say, how can I be 5% disabled? I can't go back to work. And I explain to them that the impairment rating is something that's given according to the AMA guides, and it is supposed to measure your impairment of a certain body part. In this case, it's a psychological impairment. Dr. Manlove used what's called, the acronym is PIRS. I don't remember what it stands for, but that's a rating system where he assigns a rating of between 1 and 5 in about 6 different domains. And then he takes all the points that add up and it gives him a percentage. In this case, it gave him a 22%. It's an impairment rating that he got. It's called a disability rating in his report, but immediately after he says he has the 22% disability rating, I just want to make sure I get this right. Dr. Manlove writes, he is unable to maintain employment at this time due to his conditions. So Dr. Manlove was not saying that he's 22% disabled. He was trying to give an opinion about an impairment rating, which is different.
So if the evidence could relate to causation, it could also relate in some ways to questions that we have, can you help me understand the theory, the rules that we use here today to reach the result that you're advocating for? In other words, is he obviously unemployable, or is he unemployable in fact because he can't in fact get a job? Which among those theories are we working with here?
Right. So I think that it's either that he's obviously unemployed. I mean, he's basically, if we accept what these doctors are saying, and if we accept that he has enough paranoia that he can't trust people and that he is constantly misinterpreting what people do, then I'm not an expert. I just know what Dr. Manlove said and how he described it. So I mentioned that he had rated him in those six different domains. One of the domains was adaptation. And Dr. Manlove said he is totally impaired in the area of adaptation because of his paranoia.
Is that obvious, though? Or is it only obvious to an expert? Or does it matter?
I don't know that it matters. I think in this case, we have both. We have an expert saying that it's true, Dr. Manlove, that he has a total inability to adapt himself due to his paranoia and due to his inability to react appropriately to stimuli. And then it's also obvious to anyone who reads the letters or to really anyone who looks at his treatment notes that a person who constantly throughout the course of their life, when they encounter situations, believes that the person who they're encountering is out to get them. That's his words. Dr. Manlove put it like this. He said he has a persistent and exaggerated negative beliefs or expectations about himself and others. He feels the world is dangerous and that regional hospital is out to get him. He has a persistent negative emotional state.
So that would be, in your view, that would be the obvious unemployment or obvious inability to find employment theory.
Right. Right. And I think that Dr. Manlove says that it's severe enough that he believes that he is not employable in any capacity.
Counsel, can I ask you about this statute dealing with permanent total disability? The statute refers to physical condition, employee's physical condition, but as I understand it, you're not talking about a disability, physical disability, you're talking about a mental condition. How do you reconcile your client's claim with this statute that seems to not mention mental condition?
So the circuit court dealt with that issue, and I can tell you how the circuit court kind of handled that.
I'd like to know as you say, you've been in this business for a long time. What is your, how do you reconcile it?
The circuit court reconciled it in such a way that I can be here today and I can make the argument. And I don't think that the legislature would ever have a workers' comp system where you could get permanent disability for a back injury or a shoulder injury, but you couldn't get it for an injury such as this, which is equally as debilitating. And it has been proven to be work-related. So I kind of disagree with the way the circuit court analyzed it, but because the circuit court said that you can't prove obvious unemployability for a psychological condition. I think you can, and I think the statutes can be construed that way. But the circuit court did find that you could make the case a different way. So I don't know that that issue is really before the court. But
it hasn't been argued. I think the court, as you're right, the circuit court dealt with it. Is this a case of first impression in South Dakota where we have a a purely psychiatric disability caused by workplace violence?
I don't know that. I want to say that there have been some other cases dealing with that. And I'm thinking of one, a nursing home worker that was assaulted at work and then developed some pretty significant psychological problems. I think the case was Everingham, if I remember right.
Was that the somatoform case?
Yes. Yeah. It might be, it's different than this case in some ways, obviously, but I don't know that it's, I think that it's been done before in other cases.
And after that case, of course, isn't that when the legislature changed the definition of injury to sort of take that case, or at least the idea is that it took that case into account? Would that relate more to causation? Is it compensable?
Yeah, I think so.
Is there a difference between the compensability, which is kind of my first question? I think Justice Cohen came to a better job with it. But is there a difference between the compensability determination, which doesn't seem to be in front of us, and the text of the statute, which Justice Cohen Kemp pointed out, which uses the term physical injury? Can they be reconciled?
You're at about 2 minutes.
I mean, I think that the way the circuit court reconciled it makes sense. What she did is she just said, there's another statute that says you can make your prima facie case through a job search or through medical or vocational testimony or opinions that the job search is futile. And she said that particular section of the statute doesn't mention physical, like you're mentioning. And so therefore, the legislature was not limiting that avenue to physical injuries only. And I think that makes sense. As I said before, I just can't imagine that we could interpret the statutes to cut out emotional or psychological injuries. When we have a statute that says that if you prove through clear and convincing evidence that a work injury caused a psychological condition, it's compensable. And we have that in this case.
Two different terms, though. This statute on the permanent disability talks about condition, and the other definitional statutes talk about injury. Should we make a distinction, or is it the same thing?
I don't know the answer to that question.
You're almost out of time. I want to turn your attention to suitable work. The employer says here, hey, we offered him a whole bunch of different opportunities to work. He never worked after right. 2015. There's no indication that your client attempted to look for work or attempted to obtain work. What's your response to that?
So you don't have to do a job search if the medical or vocational testimony shows that it's futile. And it's my position that the treating physicians that I've mentioned, Dr. Manlove, all would provide evidence that him looking for work is futile. And then as far as when the burden shifts, then your case law is pretty clear that the vocational expert for the insurance company has to go out and go to those employments and talk to them and say, hey, this is a person who has a total inability to adapt, according to Dr. Manlove. And in this case, the vocational expert didn't contact any of the employers about anything and basically just gave us a list of jobs for someone who could do simple work that didn't have a lot of frequent contact with others. Those were the restrictions.
And your time's up. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, you may proceed with your 20-minute argument this time.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jennifer Washi, and I represent employer Rapid City Regional Hospital, now known as Monument Health, and its workers' compensation carrier, Hartford Insurance Company, in this matter. I want to thank the Honorable Court for the opportunity to be here today for this oral argument. I would be remiss not to say that I wish my law partner and friend, Comet Haraldson, were with me today at council table. The appellant, Mr. Baker, is asking this court to determine that the Department of Labor's and the Circuit Court's decisions denying odd lot disability benefits to Mr. Baker was clearly erroneous. The Department and the Circuit Court's decisions finding Mr. Baker is not entitled to permanent total disability benefits should be affirmed because substantial evidence exists in the record to support those decisions. The Honorable Patricia Devaney aptly summarized, I believe, in her memorandum decision below. The department first concluded that Mr. Baker failed to show that his mental issues were truly disabling, and then focused on how they centered around his obsession with his workers' compensation litigation and efforts to seek redress for his grievances with his employer. The court has asked questions of appellant's counsel today what is the standard? And this is obviously dictated by statute, whether a claimant is obviously unemployable or entitled to perm total disability benefits under 62.453. Obvious unemployability may be established by one, showing that the claimant's physical condition, coupled with his education, training, and age, make it obvious that he is in the odd lot disability category, or two, persuading the trier of fact that he is in such severe debilitating pain that he is not able to work. Factor two is not at play here. Mr. Baker is not making that argument. If a claimant shows he's obviously unemployable, then the burden shifts to the employer and insurer to show some suitable employment is available within his or her limitations. But under the Sandner case, if a claimant's medical impairment is so limited or specialized in nature that he or she is not obviously unemployable, then the burden remains ultimately on the claimant to demonstrate the unavailability of suitable employment by showing he has made reasonable efforts to find work and was unsuccessful. And that's from the Sandner decision. And I think the circuit court did a good job of analyzing this burden shifting. I think Judge Devaney ultimately analyzed it under both scenarios, and under both analyses, she determined that the Department of Labor, that there was substantial evidence to support the findings and conclusions of the department, and the circuit court herself agreed.
As to the latter theory, the cannot find work because of the narrow scope of skills or training, is the futility argument available for that latter theory? I understand that it can be used and is used in sort of this obvious unemployable theory. Is it available in that alternate theory? Or you really have to show in fact, as a claimant who bears the burden throughout, no shifting, no nothing, under this second theory? Does the claimant have to show, hey, I looked? Or is futility available under that alternate theory or the second theory that you mentioned as well?
Justice Alter, I believe that it's still required. The first factor is also applicable, as well as the futility.
So if futility is available in the cannot find work theory, or it's not? In other words, you mentioned that other theory. Just they've looked because of the narrowness. They've looked. They can't find employment. Not obviously unemployable, but they've looked and they can't find it. Kind of unemployable, in fact. Is futility available to a claimant pursuing that theory?
I don't know that it is. And I think that's why our statute reads as it does. And Judge Devaney did go through that. And I believe she said on page 32 of her decision that this court has not discussed whether that phrase is simply a reference back to the prima facie showing of obvious employability, or whether it is another avenue by which a claimant can show permanent total disability. But I still think it gets back to a prima facie case that the claimant has, then the burden shifts. but that ultimately the claimant has the ultimate persuasion, ultimate burden of proving this.
Why is an opinion from a psychiatrist that someone is unemployable, that they're not capable of working, why is that not sufficient to make a prima facie case that the claimant is unemployable?
Well, I believe the circuit court below did look at the treating physician's opinions as well as Dr. Manlove's, which was, he was a forensic consultant, not a treater. And did a de novo review of all of that, all of the records. And ultimately, Judge Devaney went through each of these opinions and analyzed them thoroughly. Dr. Hatta, the treating neurologist for Mr. Baker, ultimately agreed that he could do jobs, that he had recovered from post-concussive syndrome. Dr. Hastings' notes were evaluated and analyzed by both the department and the circuit court and by Dr. Gratzer. And her notes show in her visits with Mr. Baker that he was able to maintain focus and those sorts of things as documented in the records. So I think we need to look further. I'd ask this court to look at the opinions as Judge Devaney did. Ultimately, I believe Judge Devaney gave Mr. Baker the benefit of the doubt and did say, all right, he makes a prima facie case, but then what? Even if he made a prima facie case here, then the burden shifts to employer and insurer to show, is there suitable work available within his restrictions? And she said, ultimately, yes, employer insurer did meet that burden. And then ultimately, I believe her finding was that claimant failed in his overall ultimate burden of persuasion to show he's perm total.
What is your response to the previous statement made by Mr. Simpson that the insurer's vocational expert has to go out and talk to employers in order to meet that burden?
Well, I would disagree with that, Your Honor. As Judge Devaney said, you know, we have specific cases to address that. There is no requirement in those cases that an employer is required to contact each prospective employer. What's required is that the expert's listing of jobs take into account the claimant's actual limitations or restrictions. Here, claimant's counsel did argue below that employer insurer did not contact, that their vocational expert, Mr. Gravatt, did not call each employer to see if the employer would accommodate all of claimant's restrictions. But as Judge Devaney noted at page 39 of her decision, the EITE case and the Rank versus Lindblom and Kester cases, those cases don't require that. Mr. Gravatt found several open positions for Mr. Baker in this case. Mr. Gravatt worked with one of the treating physicians, Dr. Hamlin, in fact, after Dr. Hamlin and Dr. Hatta both said, we think Mr. Baker can work. In fact, it would help him. And he just shouldn't be working with Rapid City Regional Hospital or in the medical setting, that type of thing. And so Mr. Gravatt did identify several jobs. That evidence is unrebutted in this case.
Did any of the treating physicians ever address whether they thought any of those specific positions were appropriate for his, given the extent of his impairments?
Yes, Chief Justice Jensen, Dr. Hatta was asked to review the jobs identified by Mr. Gravatt, and he said, yes, I think he can do some of these jobs. While he may not be ultimately successful in some, there's nothing to say he can't go out and try. Dr. Hatta also said that Mr. Baker, because early on, the hospital had offered him a hand washing monitor position, and he did not do that. He did not accept that position ultimately. But I think everyone agreed ultimately that Mr. Baker should not be in the hospital setting. That's what seems to affect his symptoms that he claims in this case. And so Mr. Gravatt did that and met that challenge. He identified jobs such as backroom clerk, mailroom attendant, things like that, that are not strenuous, involve very little interaction with the public and things of that nature.
So under this theory, which I call the obvious unemployment, I mean, I'm not just me, I mean, I call it the obvious unemployment theory, where futility is available, can a claimant show futility in pursuing these job options with the exact same evidence that the employee used to make a prima facie showing of obvious unemployability? Does it permeate? Does it carry through in such a way that it kind of runs the table on all these inquiries? Or should there be something different that guides us in applying, in analyzing the argument that, hey, it was futile for the claimant to even try?
I think there are two different things, because as you mentioned, Justice Salter, the legislature did amend 62.117 to discuss the clear and convincing standard for proving a mental injury as a result of a physical injury. That obviously heightened the standard to prove a mental injury. The statute itself, 62.453, only references physical condition. So I'm not sure it does carry over. I don't know that our legislature has ever spoke to that, and nor has this court. In this case, though, I think Judge Devaney analyzed it appropriately. I think it was a fair analysis. I think she analyzed it under both scenarios and ultimately still concluded that substantial evidence existed to support the department's findings in this case.
So if someone has a compensable injury, it satisfies the definition of injury, there's causation, we know it's compensable. How do we apply the permanent total statute that you just mentioned, that we've discussed earlier, and the text that references a claimant's physical condition? In other words, we know we have an injury, it's compensable, it satisfies the definition of an injury. And we're moving on now to the inquiry of what's it worth? I mean, what kind of benefits are available? And specifically, are permanent total benefits available? That statute references, as we know, a claimant's physical condition. How can that be reconciled, or how does that work with what we know to be a compensable mental injury, which the legislature has clearly spoken of?
Well, I think we can look at it as, is there a physical manifestation of a mental injury, which is, I believe, how Judge Devaney coined it. And in this case, there isn't that manifestation. I believe the treaters agreed that the post-concussive syndrome, which is the physical injury, had recovered. Then what we're left with is the claims for PTSD that he has. Then we have to look at what effect is that having on his ability to find work. Ultimately, we have to look at all of the evidence in the record, and Judge Devaney found that Mr. Baker has the ability to file 48 pro se lawsuits, small claims suits, detailed letters to various agencies, spend hours doing that.
You know, you bring up those pro se lawsuits, but you know, the department said that these lawsuits were irrational, incoherent, and rambling. So don't those lawsuits reinforce the claim that this man is mentally disabled?
I disagree, and Judge Devaney did as well, doing a de novo review of the documentary evidence in the case. I believe they support the fact that he has more ability than his subjective complaints show. Ultimately, he was able to research the law around these claims, draft letters and complaints using a computer, able to show he can concentrate and produce substantial written work. All of these filings and lawsuits, by the way, were against individuals or parties associated with Mr. Baker's workers' compensation case. And so that is what Judge Devaney ultimately looked at, is Mr. Baker's current condition seems to be related only when we're, you know, only when he's dealing with the workers' compensation litigation or anyone associated with the hospital, the insurer, defense counsel, IME experts, and the like. And that gets me to the next issue, is it is undisputed in this case, because ultimately we need to look at, under the burden shifting analysis, whether suitable work existed for Mr. Baker in his community, and did he do a good faith search or make efforts to find employment? The answer is no. He left Monument Health in June of 2015. It's undisputed in this record that he has made no efforts whatsoever to find work. We talked about the job offers that were made. Those job offers were, or prospective job offers were, within Dr. Hata's restrictions for Mr. Baker. Mr. Baker's own testimony at the hearing, by the way, he was the one sole witness at the hearing below. He was asked, have you made any efforts to find work? Do you think you're disabled? And his self-serving testimony was yes, but really couldn't say why. At his deposition, Mr. Baker would not say whether he intended to work, and would only say that he hadn't thought about it and was more concerned about surviving day to day, and that he wanted to leave South Dakota. The circuit court did conclude that given the very limited and specialized nature of Mr. Baker's mental disability, the other avenue by which he could have convinced the trier of fact that he is totally and permanently disabled was to show an unsuccessful attempt to find suitable work. Claimant failed to pursue that avenue and ultimately failed in his persuasion to show that a good faith work search would be futile.
You're at about 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to conclude by saying that Mr. Baker is arguing in this case that this department and the circuit court somehow relied on matters of inconsequence. And I think that is not the case here, especially the circuit court's decision, 42 pages, single space. This is a very thorough analysis of the evidence in this case and all of the testimony. Finally, claimant did testify live at the hearing. And the Department of Labor, although not making a specific determination of credibility, I think it can be inferred. And I think that's what Judge Devaney said as well. And I would ask this court to defer to former Director James Marsh, former director of the Department of Labor's, ability to view Mr. Baker's testimony and his demeanor at that hearing. And findings of fact or questions of credibility are questions of fact. Under the clearly
standard of review for us is we have to say that the department was clearly wrong before we can reverse it. Is that what you're saying?
Justice Konenkamp, that is absolutely correct. That's what the case law says, that the question of whether a claimant is permanently, totally disabled or entitled to odd lot benefits is a question of fact. And that would bring in the clearly erroneous statute. Also, Judge Devaney did say, if it's determined clearly erroneous is not the correct standard of review, I still did a de novo review. And she would still reach the same decision.
Are there any specific findings of fact that that Director Marsh made regarding the live testimony that we ought to be particularly paying deference to? Anything about the claimant's testimony? You started on a discussion about we should pay some deference to it. What finding did he make about what the claimant said that we ought to defer to?
I don't know that he made a specific finding, and that's what Judge Devaney was commenting on. But I think if you go back through the findings, there are findings about the lawsuits and claims that he's been able to bring. He was asked, Mr. Baker was asked about that during his testimony at the hearing, and Director Marsh was able to view him as he did testify to that. I would encourage the court.
Thank you.
I see my time has expired. Thank you.
Mr. Sampson, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Maybe I'll just start with where that got left off about the standard of review. So Judge Marsh didn't make an adverse credibility determination about Mr. Baker. He didn't say that he was lying or that he was misleading or anything. He did say that the fact that he had done some activities would argue against what the treating physician said as far as whether he would be able to work. I think that when we're trying to figure out, there's two different lines of authority. There's some case law that says that when we're reviewing documentary evidence, that it's de novo review. That's a pretty clear line of authority. And then there's the line of authority that was just mentioned that says that if it's a factual issue, then it's clearly erroneous. And then there's another one that talks about if there's a credibility determination, well, then we give deference to what the judge did. In this case, we don't have credibility. The briefs that have been submitted kind of tell us what the issues are and whether we're looking at documentary versus things that Mr. Baker said and issues of credibility. The briefs are 100% talking about what Dr. Manlove said, what Dr. Hatta said, what his writings are. They're all about the documents in the case. This is really a documentary case. The circuit court said that she looked at the causation issue with de novo review because it was primarily looking at documents, and then looked at the odd lot issue, the disability issue, using clearly erroneous. I think there's a very good argument to be made that because we're looking at mostly documents, this should be a de novo review case. So, but I think under either analysis, the claimant should prevail because of the overwhelming nature of the evidence. Judge Wickery, I wanted to come back to this question about when the burden shifts, does the vocational expert have to contact the employers? There's the Eight case. There's a recent case called Billman, where in Billman, this court held that the vocational expert failed to inform the prospective employers of, in that case, it was the age, training capabilities, and need to physically switch positions every 45 minutes, and made reference to the fact that, actually, they were citing to Eight. That was the holding in Eight. And then in Billman, they said the same thing happened. So you held that the fact that the vocational expert did not actually contact the employers and give them the actual limitations was reversible error in Billman and in Eight and in several cases before that. I think that's a pretty well established law. Justice Devaney, the circuit court, now Justice Devaney, did say in her decision, she cited those cases and said they don't stand for the proposition that an employer is required to contact each employer. But then she put in a little caveat. She said, so long as an expert's listing of available jobs takes into account a claimant's actual limitations. And as I said before, the vocational expert in this case, the only limitations that he used were that the person wouldn't have frequent contact with people, and that it would be simple work. And that's a far cry from what Dr. Manlove said and the treating psychiatrist and the treating psychologist, all of whom said he's not able to work at all because of his severe paranoia.
is there a physical condition that is a part of that opinion, and a physical condition in the sense that we're talking about the permanent total statute, is that a physical condition?
I think that, I'm not sure, but I think if you look at the circuit court's causation decision, which has not been appealed, I think she makes the finding that the claimant met the requirements of South Dakota law, that there be a physical injury, and then that lead to a psychological condition. And in this case, we don't just have something where he witnessed something and then has PTSD. He had a brain injury. He has post-concussive syndrome, and that is still a condition that he suffers from today. So he does have a physical condition that he's suffering from here. It's not a pure, he saw something tragic and now he has PTSD case. So I wanted to, there was a question about the writings, and I just wanted to call your attention to Dr. Manlove saw Mr. Baker in July of 2017. It was just a few months before the hearing. And he prepared a report, and it's at administrative record 656 through 662. In there, he, when he's doing his mental status exam, instead of kind of summarizing the content of Mr. Baker's thoughts, he just kind of, he says here, he included a verbatim account of his thoughts so that the reader might get a feel for Mr. Baker's thought disorder, paranoia, hypervigilance, and the degree of his impairment. And I would just ask you to read the rantings that Mr. Baker told this psychiatrist. The fact that he believed that he was going to be assassinated, that he had, and then that he had been to the FBI for protection, that he was thinking about changing his name. It goes on and on and on. And these are the types of things that are in the writings. When we look at those federal court lawsuits, which are basically just forms that he's writing his rantings in, he's saying, I want protection. I fear for my life. To say that these writings are somehow evidence that he could be employable in the workforce, they're exactly the opposite. I think I said this in the brief. If anyone can read those writings and read the opinions and the symptoms that he has in his treatment notes and say that they would give this man a job or that he could actually be employed in the competitive economy, I think it becomes so incredibly obvious when you look at the actual documents in this case. And I guess that circles back for me to where I first started. We're not experts who deal with these people every day. Dr. Hamlin is. His opinion was that he could not work, and he backed it up with his treatment notes. Dr. Hastings, the psychologist, in September of 15 said he couldn't work, never took that back. Dr. Manlove, a psychiatrist with many years of experience, saw him 5 times. That was his opinion. So the people who know best and who treat these conditions every day are in agreement. There's been mention of Dr. Hatta. Dr. Hatta is a neurologist. He admitted in his deposition that he's not a psychiatrist. He would defer to the psychiatrist and the psychologist in this case. And in fact, the circuit court noted in the opinion that the fact that the Department of Labor relied on Dr. Hatta in the causation part of the case was an error because Dr. Hatta had clearly deferred to psychological experts. So in other words, the fact that Dr. Hatta in his deposition says, well, I think he might be able to do this light duty job, or he might be able to do that, doesn't really overcome the fact that the experts in the case, the psychological experts, all were unanimous. So unless there are other questions, I think I'm going to sit down.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank both counsel for your arguments in this case. The case is now submitted, and we'll be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.